Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile, with yet another episode about the people versus O.J. Simpson. This is Jim Clemente, and I am a former New York City prosecutor and former FBI supervisory special agent and profiler, now retired. And today with me is...
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and criminal behavioral analyst trained at the FBI and New Scotland Yard.
And...
Lisa Zambetti, I'm a casting director for Criminal Minds, where I work with my dear colleague, Jim Clemente, and I cast killers and victims and everything in between.
Awesome. So today we're going to get back to the subject of the people versus O.J. Simpson. And we were talking last time about, I think we talked a little bit about episodes 4 and 5, but we're going to go into a little more detail. But the first thing, we all agreed that the name of episode 4, which on the TV show is 100% Not Guilty, is probably a little inaccurate, and we wanted to change it. And in honor of Ron Goldman, we're going to call episode 4 Ron Goldman, because I think he was the forgotten victim, the one that very few people ever mentioned. And there's probably some reasons, some legitimate and some not legitimate, that that happened. But we'll discuss that today. And I think we all agree that the most poignant scene in this entire series so far was when Ron's father, Mr. Goldman,
Fred Goldman,
made a statement about the fact that his son was sort of a footnote, something that nobody really paid attention to, when in fact he was a living, vibrant human being, and he deserved to get a little more airtime, not only in this series, but in the media in general.
And we'd like to redress it, wouldn't we? We've done a special on Nicole, and we talked about her across our last two podcasts. She too was a footnote in the show itself. Mm-hmm. And certainly we all feel that it's important to talk about Ron, the person that he was, understanding him through the eyes of those who knew him best, his friends, his family, his sister Kim, who talks incessantly about him. And the fact that, you know, certainly for me, I feel... people always talk to families who have been bereaved about this thing called closure, in inverted commas. And Kim makes a very clear case. There's no closure for families. You know, even if they had worked through some of the psychological torment of the trial, even the show itself just brings everything back up with no consideration to how it feels for those families. And she and Fred Goldman, her father, have said, you know, they felt really compelled to have to watch this series, even though they didn't want to, because they needed to know how they were going to be portrayed.
Yeah.
And speaking of the portrayal, I just want to give a shout out to the actor who actually plays Fred Goldman in the series, who I think is doing an astonishing job. And that's probably part of the reason why you were so affected, Jim. And his name is Joseph Schiavo. He's a longtime actor. And actually, also the actress who plays Kim Goldman is Jessica Blair Herman. So I just want to give a shout out to those actors who it must be very difficult for them to, as a big responsibility, to play real people who are really still alive and tell their story. So
what's
amazing, give a shout out to them.
Yeah. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because what is amazing is that I remember the shots of them coming and going from the trial, and certain shots of them in the trial during the actual proceedings. And I think it was always terrible that they were sort of the image of the victims. They were the ones that kept it going. I know Nicole's sister was a witness in the trial. I know she testified very strongly, I think very compellingly, about what her sister went through and some of the things that had preceded her murder. But I think Ron's visage was just gone, except for his father and his sister sitting there every day. And there were some very emotional things that they had to go through. And I thought when, in this particular scene, when they finally did address Ron's family, at the sort of depiction of pain and suffering on the part of family members who are the secondary victims when somebody is murdered. I mean, how do you ever recover from that, especially when it's somebody who was so brutally taken away.
Well, I'd certainly argue, as I always do, with those who I represent, victims, and from my own experience, certainly the criminal justice system re-victimises you over and over again. And I think that's what we see across, you know, the portrayal, but also when I've listened to what Fred and Kim have said subsequently about the actual show itself, you know, that they feel very much that people have said this show is not about the victims, and they say, yeah, they completely understand that. It's living up to that because they are the footnotes yet again. And, of course, that is how it's the show, well, the trial happened. But how can they ever move on when this show on FX is everywhere? You know, that it is in their face and they do have to confront it and deal with it. And, you know, it opens up everything else for them again. So I think certainly from their point of view and you know, listening to what they say, there are some parts of the show that are factually inaccurate, you know, where the facts, where there's quite a lot of flexibility and, you know, fudged reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that must be very difficult for them to watch too.
Right. We here at Real Crime Profiler are not falling into that same trap. We are honoring Ron today. We are honoring the fact that he was a human being, that he deserved better than this, and he certainly did not deserve to be murdered brutally. But when we actually look at the crime scene, we talked about the brutality of that crime scene. And when we, as profilers, when we look at a crime scene like this, when there's multiple victims, when one of the victims gets a more brutal amount of the rage that we see exhibited at the crime scene, we typically can say that that person is most likely the main target.
And we have to look at that, don't we, Jim? We have to work out what's primary, what's secondary. And it's not necessarily saying that one person is valued more than another,
no,
but it's working out what's motivating
exactly
this particular offender or offenders.
So one gets more focused on than the other just by trying to solve the crime. So
right. Yeah. And what
well, it
what
normally
we're
would take
to
you to the perpetrator, you see.
Yes,
so that's why
motive.
It's really important.
Yeah. It reveals the motive. In other words, if somebody is quickly dispatched and another person, there's more time, or it's done in a much more personal way or much more violent or graphic or brutal way, that person is typically the person who was the main target of the offender. Sometimes you'll see one victim has fought or struggled more, and therefore you'll see defensive wounds, and you'll see indicators that they did not go down easily. I think that's the case with Ron. I think even though he was blitz attacked, because I believe that's what happened first, that they were both blitz attacked, incapacitated momentarily, and then the killer or killers went back after them and actually brutally murdered them. But when you see that he has some defensive wounds and that the stabbing, for example, in his legs, indicates that he was struggling more
and probably
than Nicole
kicking
was able
out.
To. Yes,
given the placement of the stab wounds, he was karate trained.
Yes.
So you know, this lends itself to the theory that potentially somebody could have been holding him
right
from behind,
which we've mentioned. Yeah,
we have talked
before
about that,
yeah,
and he's kicking out with his legs. I mean, he had in excess of 20 stab wounds on his person, so he
right
certainly did fight back. He was not complicit or compliant by any means. Certainly my belief is that, you know, he was trying to be the hero here and save Nicole,
right,
as he'd played the hero before with his sister, saving her from a car crash with very little forethought for himself. And I think that tells us a huge amount about Ron and the type of person that he was.
Absolutely, and I think that's important for us to dwell on here today. The fact is that most likely, the reason why he lost his life is because he was probably fighting to save Nicole's life. And this is one of the things that Dr. Lee, those defensive wounds that you talked about, Laura, Dr. Lee theorized that there were multiple attackers, that it wasn't just one person, that somebody was actually holding Ron from behind while somebody else was stabbing him. Now, I've heard other people try to explain that by saying that actually it could have been done by one person if that person was very strong and able to hold him and pin his arms with one arm. In other words, from behind, reaching around the right shoulder, around holding in one arm under his arm and then grabbing the other arm, his left arm, and pulling him tight together, thus controlling both arms with one hand and using the other hand to stab.
But of course, he was over 6 foot. He was a big guy. He was in good physical shape. I'm talking about Ron. Mm-hmm. You know, he would go to the gym. He would work out. He was in good physical shape. So it would take someone of bigger stature or by taking them by surprise in those initial seconds.
Right.
But I think to overpower Ron in that way, it would have to be someone of significant height, weight, and force.
Yeah, perhaps somebody who was a professional athlete. And what most people don't realize is when you're talking about somebody who plays professional sports, they're not just good at that sport. They're in the top 0.1% of athletes that play that particular sport. They are incredibly well-conditioned, and even after they retire, they can still maintain an incredible level of proficiency, strength, and ability, and agility, particularly professional football. So it's just something that we need to keep in mind when we think about how this crime was actually accomplished. And just so the listeners know, a blitz attack is when an immediate, sudden, overwhelming application of force is used. That's typically done only when somebody either can't approach the person and talk them into it, or when they have to control somebody immediately. So if there are two victims, then there's a need to do immediate control so that A, they don't get overwhelmed, the offender doesn't get overwhelmed, and B, they don't run away. One of them doesn't run away while the other one is being dealt with.
Or call for help, or, you know, be able to
raise the alarm.
So there's a lot to try and control, you know, on those initial minutes or seconds, really, particularly when you've got two people like Ron and Nicole, both of whom, you know, seemingly non-compliant. And, you know, there's a lot more we can say about the crime scene. I think we'll probably come back to that at some point, Jim. But I think it would be worth, you know, I think it's certainly worthwhile us going through some of our understanding of who Ron was
right.
as a person.
I thought we could kind of go back in time and talk about who he was and how he kind of came to be in Brentwood, early 90s, and talk a little bit about his family and his background. So you want to start, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I think we learn quite a lot from Kim and Father Fred. I mean, certainly they've done the most interviews about him, trying to honour his life and create a legacy. And certainly some of the things that I've learned just through reading and watching their interviews was that, yes, he was a young, successful, and I mean successful in the sense that he could turn his hand seemingly to anything. He could be a tennis coach, a model, an actor. He wanted to set up his own restaurant. That's what he sort of settled on. But he had model-like looks. He was very charming, seemingly very likable, had lots of friends, was the type of person that people wanted to be around, the popular guy at school or college, and, you know, incredibly likable. And he was also somebody who, you know, spent time volunteering, helping children with cerebral palsy. You know, this is somebody with a huge heart and a huge amount of love to give and a huge sense of fun and excitement, you know, going out on weekends, wanting to be in the clubs and bars, which any young guy that kind of age or young female would want to do. And so, you know, we start to get much more of a three-dimensional sense of who he was. And
right.
he only knew Nicole for a relatively short time, but they seemed to get on well, and it was the start of a new friendship. And he certainly seemed to be somebody who put others over and above himself. He was fairly selfless in rescuing his sister, who could have died in the car crash. And without a thought for his own welfare, he dived in and saved her.
Right. So let's go back to that. So the family is actually from Chicago, Illinois. And at a very young age, the mother abandoned the family. And so it was just Ron, his little sister, and Fred. And then shortly thereafter that, the mother came back, Laura, and what?
Well, took the two children.
Yeah, she basically kidnapped
forcefully.
Them. Yeah.
And it was a kidnapping, and told the children, I think they were age 4 and 7, that that Dad didn't want to be with them anymore. And he then had a legal battle on his hands to try and get the children back, which he was successful in. So this must have been fairly, you know, at the age of 4 and 7,
pretty traumatic,
confusing and traumatic and upsetting for them. Seemingly, Mum doesn't really enter into their lives thereafter.
No, once Fred gets custody of them, she just sort of leaves them and he doesn't hear from her for years, it doesn't sound like.
But the legacy of it is that Kim and Rom were incredibly close.
Right.
And seemingly, you know, the best of friends and spent a huge amount of time together, you know, and had a very loving relationship and with their father. So that triangulation between them, you know, sounds like a hugely healthy, supportive, loving family dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that reflected really on the type of man that Ron grew up to be.
So they were in a car accident. I believe they were hit by a drunk driver when Kim was 13.
Yep.
They were all in the car, and Ron went back into the car and pulled her out of the car, I believe. And she was severely burned.
She was. She had third-degree burns,
yeah.
And
so
he dragged her from the car.
And he was screaming to, apparently, he was screaming to the paramedics, get my sister, you know, and all that.
And he didn't give up on her.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we see what she has done in his name and his honour, she and the father, Fred, have not given up their fight for justice,
mm-hmm.
and still continuing to this day.
And after their time in Chicago, the family moved to L.A., and Ron followed shortly thereafter. He went to college, I think, for 1 year and dropped out and went to follow his dad and his sister to L.A., and he dove right in to the L.A. scene, trying to find his way, trying anything, like lots and lots of, you know, guys do who come to the land of dreams in L.A.
The Hollywood bubble.
Yeah.
And living in Brentwood. And,
yep.
You know, it appears that he was holding down several different jobs, mm-hmm. and struggled to pay his rent. And I think it's interesting he chose Brentwood. You know, it's kind of a cool place. And would rather pay the higher rent and live somewhere cool. That probably mm-hmm. says a little bit about him, that he was, you know, a mover and a shaker, but was seeking fun, as,
yeah.
you know, anyone would do of that age, wanting
sure.
to go out and seek out fun. And he had a lot of friends.
And he wasn't perfect. I mean, it looks like he racked up some money in credit card debt that his dad got really pissed off about and wouldn't, you know, bail him out of that, but said, no, you gotta
work
through this.
Yourself.
Yeah, I mean, like so many people do, and he had expired driver's licenses, so he wasn't this perfect, idealized person. You know, he was a real normal guy. I was telling Laura that I went to visit during that time, in the early 90s, I went to visit some friends who were going to UCLA, and, you know, we went to a bunch of parties and saw guys just like Ron, you know, just enjoying the scene, and you know, like you said, sometimes you're waitering, sometimes you're teaching tennis, you're trying to just make it in
Although
the city.
He'd got his license as well, hadn't he, as an emergency
mm-hmm.
medical technician.
Right.
So, you know,
he was
doing lots of different things
to help people.
Yeah,
yeah.
Some of which were to help people, absolutely. But it seems that just at the point where he was murdered, that he had a real burning ambition that he wanted to, you know, open up his own restaurant or bar, and that was
right.
sort of the plan that he
right.
was you know, executing and wanting to work on.
Right. So he was young, and he was a young man who's in a vibrant city, and he's interacting with people, and one of the people he meets is Nicole Simpson, and apparently they struck up a friendship, and there's no indication that they actually had an intimate relationship.
I think a neighbor introduced them, you know, in a coffee house, and they went to the same gym. And seemingly no relationship between them, because his best friend said that, you know, he would talk about those things.
I think she was friends with a lot of his friends who were at this coffee place, and they would see each other every day, you know, after
right.
workouts and stuff. It's nothing unusual
right.
at all about it.
No, but I think the interesting point was that his best friend, who was a guy, said that he would tell, you know, him when he was dating women. And he didn't talk about Nicole in that way. Yes, he was excited being with her and enjoyed her company, but there was no conversation about an intimate relationship.
Right. And so, which sort of brings us to one of the reasons why we're discussing this, and that is, this is all part of victimology. And victimology is the study of the victim. Anything you could possibly learn or know about a victim, because victims, as I explained in an earlier episode, victims are chosen by offenders. They're picked out among all the people in the world, a particular victim at a particular place, at a particular time, in a particular manner, for a particular purpose. And those choices actually leak out information about the offender. So we assign a risk level to victims based on their behavior, their lifestyle, their behavior, things they're into, their hobbies, their good aspects and bad aspects. And for example, in this case, You would look at who he hung out with. What activities did he engage in? Was he a drug dealer who was constantly, you know, meeting people who were involved in a very violent drug trade? Or was he actually just involved with people who were not criminals, who were just regular, everyday people? Was his job, you know, risky, very dangerous? No, he worked at a restaurant, a nice restaurant, and he met nice people there for the most part. And he didn't engage in activities that would have raised his risk level to the point where he would have a grave risk of somebody taking his life. So it's a very narrow pool of people who could have had access to him, who would have had access to him. And it is evident in that lifestyle that he was not sort of walking around with a target on his back, that he was in high risk of being killed. So we would assign, I think we could all agree, that he was a low-risk victim.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, the opposite was true. He was a very, very likable guy. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody liked him and gravitated towards him. And we all know those kinds of people. Mm-hmm. They're fun to be around. You know, he was mischievous but charismatic. And everyone wanted to be around him.
If you want to get a sense of actually really what it was like, there is a YouTube clip. He appeared on the show called Studs, which was hilarious. I remember watching this when I was much younger, where it's like a dating show, and a bunch of guys go on and they go on a date with girls. And so Ron was on this show, and if you watch the clip, I mean, he's sitting there with another guy, total bros. And if he were Italian, Jimmy, we would say he was a gumbatz. Okay. I mean, he's like
one of the guys.
He's one of the guys, and he's just funny, and he's arrogant, and he's everything that a early 20s guy should be.
Playfully arrogant, right?
Playfully, course. But I mean, he likes the girl he's going on dates with. And I'll post this clip on our Facebook page. But you'll see, hear his voice, you see how he's dressed. He's just a normal guy and charming.
Yeah, so when you look at that, then you find, when you look at the circumstances surrounding Ron Goldman, and then you try to figure out how did he come into contact with somebody who would end up killing him. And it's very unfortunate, but the fact is that when you come into contact with somebody who actually is in the middle of a long, drawn-out domestic violence situation, that you can actually, even if you're just peripherally involved in that person's life, you could actually raise the risk level tremendously.
Wrong time, wrong place. And,
exactly.
You know, sadly, that's seemingly what happened here, that he goes to drop off Nicole's mother's sunglasses because 11 of them had dinner in the restaurant. And it seems that for all intents and purposes, he was going to go out that night with other people. So he goes round to Nicole's. He's already been back to change, having been at the restaurant. And then he goes round to Nicole's. And in that split moment of timing, unfortunately, that's where he's in the wrong time, wrong place,
right,
and he loses his life.
And so we would call that a mixed risk victim. In other words, there is a mix of low risk and one high risk moment, basically. It's sort of like if you're a low risk person and you're commuting back and forth to work every day, but you get a flat tire and you pull off the highway in an area that happens to be, let's say, a drug trade area or a gang area. And even though you're a very low-risk victim, now you've just sort of accidentally engaged in behavior that makes the risk of you getting hurt very high. And that actually is most likely what happened here. Whether the person that killed Nicole was laying in wait, thinking that she was going to have a boyfriend come over and attacked as soon as they saw Ron, thinking that Ron was her boyfriend, or whether actually this guy was in the middle of attacking Nicole when Ron showed up, we don't know exactly. But it could have been either of those scenarios, and either way, he just, as Laura said, was there at the wrong place at the wrong time.
And it shouldn't matter if they were hooking up or not. I mean, can I just say that doesn't, you know, you hear people saying, well, he was this, he was that, and they were hooking up. It's somehow that means that he had it coming. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter whatsoever whether they were friends or more than friends.
But the only reason why it's important to Jim and I mm-hmm. to understand that is you're trying to work out sequencing of what's going mm-hmm. on. So, you know, Nicole had candles that were lit. You know, had she gone home from the restaurant and that she was meeting someone back at hers? So we all know, certainly as ladies, we have candlelit baths. It doesn't mean to say it's a romantic situation as such.
She also had a bowl of ice cream. I mean, would she, if she was, if she was planning to have somebody come over to spend time with her, would she sit down with one bowl of ice cream first? I don't know.
Well, that doesn't make sense. And certainly from Ron's part, he was going out that night. So it looks like that that was not the situation. But what it tells us about and why it's important to us is about the crime scene, which you understand the what, the where, the when, the why, the how. It would normally take you to the who. So actually working out who's the primary victim again, you know, and doing the victimology, as Jim said, is a really important point. But normally when it's a female male, people jump to all the wrong conclusions. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you, Lisa.
Yeah,
and assume that there's some intimate relationship where, you know, that's not always the case.
Yeah, the intimate relationship in outside of crime scene reconstruction is irrelevant. But if we actually look at the circumstances, her two children were asleep in bed. She had laid out a bath with candles around it. And she had a bowl of ice cream downstairs. Now, she had just announced to her sister, I believe that very day, right?
She was moving on with her life?
Yes, moving on. She was going to start taking care of herself and enjoy the rest of her life. And so this might have been her little treat to herself. But it just so happens that day is the same day that O.J. Simpson's girlfriend broke up with him.
So two rejections in one day, which that context, again, is really important. You know, we normally see a trigger event before something catastrophic happens. So, again, when we look at crime scene, we look at, you know, the antecedents, what's going on. We're trying to understand what exactly was happening. And certainly those two triggers for me are significant in this case. Certainly when we put it in the context, as Lisa and I discussed on our bonus, the 14-year diaries charting abuse, not just incident after incident, but the absolute psychological terror that Nicole felt and that she was trying to leave him. And were people talking to her about leaving safely, you know, and how that process should be managed? And we certainly talked about the letters as well. So, I mean, I think certainly listening to what Kim says, you know, the fact that he was also, Ron was also camp counsellor, you know, in terms of helping people. And it seems that she has now carried on quite a lot of that legacy. She seems to be a very, you know, inspirational woman herself in the work that she does now for a not-for-profit, but working with teenagers and counselling them and using some of her experience to help others, I think is, you know, shows a huge amount of humility and certainly is incredibly inspirational.
Yeah. I think it's an amazing testament to, you know, that family that they've been so strong and been able to sort of stay together, you know, even today, given all the sort of reopening of old wounds. They're still a family unit, and they're still very dedicated to keeping Ron's memory alive and keeping all the tarnish they can off of it, because clearly people would have it other ways, especially the defense.
Absolutely. I mean, the smear campaign that they ran, and, you know, depending on what you read and where you read it, you can get a very difficult understanding of who Ron was, or a very different one from, you know, the truth and the facts and the evidence. So that's why this particular episode is an important one for us, of looking at the truth and the fact and the evidence of who he was. So one of the reasons why we spend a lot of time talking about victims and talking about risk and explaining risk factors and behaviour is that we know that people out there who are listening are directly enduring or surviving abuse. And we have had a number of really moving and also concerning and risk-based emails and Facebook messages and tweets and private messages being sent to us. And certainly why I spend a lot of time talking about risk factors and the risk model and signposting people to those tools is because we know that people will look them up and it can be an opportunity to save someone's life. And Lisa contacted both Jim and I this week with a very specific email that we had received. And she's going to read out just the context to it. But I certainly believe that it's one where something very serious was happening for somebody and they have now received the help that they require. And a lot of it came down to the conversations that we had on Real Crime Profile and the DASH risk model.
So I just wanted to read an email from one of our listeners. She writes, I just want to share something that happened to me earlier this week that involved your podcast. I'm studying for a diploma in mental health support and addiction services, and we were conducting a supervision exercise. And a classmate told me about a family she's just started working with, a single mother and her teen daughter. The daughter told my classmate about an incident from her last visit with her father, where he got into a big argument with his new partner, choked the partner, and used that chokehold to drag her into a different part of the house where he beat her. The new partner also has a young baby with this man, and thanks to Laura, those of us who listen to Real Crime Profile know that choking and pregnancy childbirth are red flags for domestic violence homicide. So I shared that with my classmate. I told her about the DASH risk assessment checklist, gave her the link to it and some other useful resources, including this podcast. As a result, she's now taking the matter to her bosses, and they will be contacting the father and his partner to try to get some interventions and supports in place before this woman comes to any more serious harm. So thank you for what you guys do. You are not just entertaining us. You are educating us too, and potentially saving lives, even here in New Zealand. You guys, when I read that, I was just blown away. I can't even tell you. I was gobsmacked, I think.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, obviously. And I think you guys should be proud of the episode that you did, particularly talking about that DASH risk model and so forth. I know you've mentioned in a number of our podcasts, Laura, but actually putting that together, I mean, you've mentioned a few times how many murders that you've prevented in the city of London, and I'm sure the ripple effect of those murders goes out to affect hundreds and thousands of people's lives, and each year that somebody's life is saved, I mean, it's just an immeasurable effect that you've had on people's lives, and you should be very proud of the work that you do.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Jim, but for me, it's about the hundreds of thousands of professionals who are out there on the front line that we educate. I'm glad I've played a part in that, but it's the women and the men who are the unsung heroes who are out there as advocates, who are lifelines whenever a victim does reach out, and they say and do and they believe and they do the right things. They have a different understanding of abuse because we have trained them, and that's a really important part of the process, raising awareness, talking about intervention and prevention, not judging people but believing them, asking the right types of questions at the right time. And, you know, as we always said in the Metropolitan Police Service, first time, right time. You don't get a second chance with a lot of these cases. So when people do reach out, we want to make sure that people are using the right tools. And the reason why I talk about the DASH isn't just because it's something that I developed on behalf of the Association of Chief Police Officers. You know, it's a tool that is evidence-based that has, when people have used it appropriately, made a big difference to the lives of many victims, women and men, and also children. So we do want people to use, you know, the right accredited tools.
And you really called it, Laura, a couple podcasts ago when you said to me, you know, you don't know when somebody's going to reach out to you. You know, it's a very fleeting moment when somebody will trust you. And I think this email just kind of proves that. It was sort of a, I don't know how to really describe it, but it was a daughter who confided in a student who confided, you know, it was a chain of events that you had to be aware of in order to help.
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, I've risk assessed thousands of victims, and whilst I'm profiling them, guess what they're doing to me? And guess what they're doing to every advocate? They're profiling us back to work out whether it's safe to tell us, how much they should tell us, you know, and we can have leakage too, where maybe the look on our face says something, a judgment, or so there's lots of things. When we train people on the DASH, we train them in communication skills, you know, as well as how to ask the questions in the right way and what risk looks like. As Jim mentioned, you know, we can have victims who are high risk, medium risk and standard risk. And that doesn't mean to say we take any case any less seriously, but it just means that maybe there are different levels of intervention, and it's a multi-agency intervention. It's not just law enforcement, that we put around, you know, a team around the victim and their children, and make sure that we operate in a way that's safe for them, that we understand the risks that they're telling us, but we put the right measures in place to keep them alive. And it is as serious as that.
And I want to thank our listener who posted that to our Real Crime Profile Facebook page. Please follow up and let us know what happens in that case. We'd love to hear.
So we are happy to have dedicated this episode of Real Crime Profile to Ron Goldman and his family. And we hope that it will sort of get people to think a little bit more about the victims of crimes and the ripple effect it has on their families, because I think everybody in this room has had something happen to them and their families, and it does really affect and change your lives. Laura, do you have any final words on Ron that you want to share?
Yeah, well, just that, you know, the listeners have to bear in mind that there never is any closure for families. And I do hear that said a lot when I work with families who are bereaved. Certainly my experience is that they learn how to exist in a different way. They adapt, but there is no closure when you lose the person that you love. And I think we, not just as professionals, but also society, need to move away from those comments, of talking about closure for people. And certainly the Goldmans have done some incredible things around, you know, the foundation, and certainly Kim has written a number of books as well, because it is the ripples on the pond. Life is never the same again.
Mm-hmm. And if you'd want to know more about Ron, you can certainly track down his sister Kim's book, His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice, that she wrote. She also wrote another book called Can't Forgive, and her latest book is called Media Circus. She, Kim Goldman, is also the executive director of the Santa Clarita Valley Youth Project, which is a nonprofit organization that provides mentoring and crisis intervention. And of course, there is the Ron Goldman Foundation for Justice that she's the co-chair of. So you can find all of those online. If you Google search those, you can find out more about Ron and his family.
Well, thank you so much for listening to Real Crime Profile. We'll be back again soon.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions.